Hello and welcome to the debate. I'm Behrouz Najafi. An affront to justice. That's how the UN has described President Trump's recent pardons for Blackwater mercenaries. Rights experts complain that a pardon for the four security contractors convicted of killing Iraqi civilians in 2007 undermines humanitarian law. UN experts have reminded the fact that based on the Geneva Convention, war criminals must be held accountable for their crimes even when acting as private security contractors. That's the topic of our debate show tonight. Stay with us for that. Now let's go to Washington, D.C. to our own correspondent, Dr. Colin Campbell. Colin, last week we were discussing the same issue from a different angle, and there was media blackout. The majority of mainstream U.S. media didn't mention this. So now the UN has taken it to a different level. It's now some kind of legal challenge. What about now?
That's right, and it looks like the media has picked up on it a little bit, really expressing outrage from some of the commentators that have remarked about the pardons that the president made for these contractors from Blackwater. As we understand, this was an egregious crime that was committed with the slaughter of innocent Iraqi civilians that were later the perpetrators of this crime, now can walk free. So you have some media outlets, if they aren't just saying and stating what happened as a declarative, they're expressing outrage, anger, and just disbelief that these would be the people that the president has pardoned. Now, what is being looked at also is just the whole pardoning process. I think that the president has put a test on the whole system of who is pardoned and why. Usually it is for people who were not afforded equity in under the eyes of the law. Maybe there was a law that was misapplied, or maybe something that was done unjudiciously, or something that was done a little bit too exacting or too draconian in method. Well, this time it seems that this was the prevalent president's privilege that he took to pardon people that he felt should be pardoned, or some people who were giving deference to the president. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why there are many people who are now questioning just the whole system of who is pardoned. Again, this is not the main story that is coming from U.S. media, but it is something that is being discussed, especially amongst those who are at liberty to discuss the topics of the day with a little bit more freedom in their rhetoric rather than just mm-hmm. stating the news of the day as a flat declarative.
Okay, thank you, Doc. Our own Colin Campbell in Washington, D.C. Now, joining me to discuss this a little bit and look at it from different angles, first will be former independent expert with the UN Human Rights Council, Alfred Desaias, out of Geneva. Good to have you with us, Alfred. Welcome to the show. And, you know, as you know, these security contractors took the lives of Iraqi civilians back in 2007. On what ground has President Trump pardoned them?
Well, we have a culture of impunity in the United States, and this is only one of many cases. Constitutionally, the president does have the authority to pardon criminals, except that in this case, basically, he's giving his blessing on murder, his blessing on a massive war crime. But it's not just the practice of granting pardons. It's also the consistent pattern of impunity for American soldiers who commit crimes and for private security companies whose members, and we had nearly 100,000 private security officials in Iraq at the time, and there were many other major crimes committed. It's not just this one in Nusra Square in 2007. I remember the crimes committed at the time of the rape of Fallujah, and we know the crimes committed in Guantanamo as a daily torture situation that has been repeatedly condemned by United Nations rapporteurs, and all of these persons involved in these crimes have enjoyed and continue enjoying impunity. As an American, I can say, not in my name. I mean, I find it egregious. I find it outrageous. But as Campbell just said, the mainstream media doesn't like to carry these stories. I recall when I was a young student at Harvard, that was during the Vietnam War, and there were all of these war crimes committed by American soldiers against the Vietnamese people, civilians, women, children. Very little made it to the press, and it was us, the activists, the students, who were protesting because we had heard about these things and we wanted to see accountability on the part of American soldiers. Who was tried? This insignificant Lieutenant William Calley, instead of trying General Maxwell Taylor, instead of holding the hires up accountable for the systematic crimes being committed in Vietnam. And for decades now, since the beginning of the so-called war on terror, we have had a problem of so-called secret prisons, the problem of extraordinary renditions. Mm-hmm. And my colleague and rapporteur on human rights while combating terrorism, Ben Emerson, did a study on extraordinary renditions. And it turned out that 54 countries in the world participated in the extraordinary renditions. And countries like Poland, Romania, Egypt, etc., all participated in this completely illegal program of kidnapping and sending people to be tortured. I mean, we had special agreement with Egypt, and we sent people specifically to be tortured in Egypt. Wow. And of course, we continued the torture in Guantanamo, and as I said, in total impunity, because no one has ever been held accountable.
Okay. Now let me also invite Senior Analyst with Foreign Policy and Focus, Ian Williams, out of New York. Good to have you with us, sir. Ian, rights groups argue that allowing private security firms like Blackwater to operate with impunity in armed conflicts will embolden the states to circumvent their obligations under humanitarian law. Is that true?
Yes, quite clearly. I was present at the first, the negotiations that led to the signing of the UN, of the International Criminal Court. Mm-hmm. And I spoke to a lot of the State Department and U.S. military analysts and lawyers who were involved. And their sincere thesis was that because the law only allowed for prosecution if the state concerned had failed, then it was okay. Americans were protected because they said, we have the best military justice system in the world. I had memories of Mille, like our other interlocutor there, where you might remember it took something like 30 years for the pilot of the helicopter that stopped the massacre to be recognized by Bill Clinton. But Bill Clinton was the president at the time and was at least paying lip service when the treaty was signed. We know that the U.S. couldn't ratify it because of Republican opposition, and it's on the basic same principle. The U.S. can never do any wrong. I mean, it's American exceptionalism to the max. First of all, the U.S. can do no wrong. And secondly, that anyone wearing a uniform must be supported, which we're seeing with police impunity, with military impunity. He shot somebody in full daylight who was unarmed, but he's a policeman doing his duty, so we must support him. It's that attitude that pervades the whole system. And it really has come out here because these people were they were paid security guards. They were like the doorman in a nightclub. I mean, it's like the bouncer in a nightclub, the option to kill people at will. And internationally, that's how it will be seen. This was a clear massacre. Not the only one, by the way. They haven't even tried to investigate the massacre in the square that WikiLeaks revealed, where a helicopter up in the air, it was gunned down, a Reuters camera crew and then gunned down the people who went to rescue them and give them medical aid. That hasn't even been investigated yet, let alone prosecuted. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, this is a whole level of impunity which needs examination. Of course, we know, in fact, that the people who leaked that, they are being persecuted by the government, but not the people who kept it secret, who did it, who ordered it, who provided the circumstances, empowered those people to go in and kill civilians. And it's bad for the U.S. in every way, not just morally, but if you're going to be cynical, it means that their word is worth nothing when it comes to looking for war criminals abroad. Who would hand over somebody to the United States as a suspected war criminal, knowing the United States' partial record, where that they protect the guilty when it's theirs and persecute the innocent when they're foreigners?
Okay. Now back to Geneva. Alfred, UN rights experts are also warning that pardons and amnesties, I'm quoting them, open doors for future abuses when states use the service of private military and security companies for inherent state functions. Do you share the same opinion?
Well, I written that in some of my old reports to the Human Rights Council and to the General Assembly. Indeed, in the ontology of the state is to keep an army and to keep discipline in that army. The main problem with private security companies is that it's an attempt to outsource this ontological responsibility of the state. And there the so-called status of forces abroad agreements that essentially grant them total immunity in the countries where they're operating, in this case Iraq, on the assumption that if they commit a crime that they will be under in personam jurisdiction of United States courts, and that the military will actually investigate those allegations of war crimes, and that those responsible will be brought to justice. Well, here we have four individuals from Blackwater who were, in fact, brought to court and convicted back in 2014 for murder. Now, it is a disgrace for a country under the rule of law that it would be tolerated that a crime as egregious as this one would be subject to pardoning. But as Mr. Trump said, these were people who had a long history of service to our nation, and therefore they deserve being pardoned. Now, this is like a mafia boss saying, well, they're my boys. You know, my boys are good boys. And that, when I was a young student in high school in Chicago, I mean, I remember the kind of daily indoctrination, if you want. You know, I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What does that mean? Is that we are indoctrinated in believing that we, Americans, are, by definition, the good guys. We're always the good guys. Our soldiers do not commit war crimes. Our private military security officers do not commit war crimes. Only the other side commits war crimes. And that's why what we need is universal jurisdiction.
Right.
So that countries, other than the United States, when an American official goes to, say, Switzerland, that if he is, say, the Minister of Defense, and he comes to Switzerland, well, he has responsibility for all the war crimes that have been committed under his jurisdiction,
right,
if he has not ensured accountability.
Mm-hmm.
So universal jurisdiction is a concept that has to be played in.
Right. Now, Ian, in a statement announcing this controversial pardons just a few days ago, the White House said that the move was broadly supported by the public and also backed by a number of Republican lawmakers. Is that really the case?
Well, I'm fairly sure it was backed by a large number of Republican lawmakers, because they're looking over their shoulders at the Trump supporters who will or won't vote for them. I mean, you know, if Adolf Hitler had the good sense to wear a GI's uniform, these people would all be supporting him, no problem. But on the other side, if they were putting when we're talking about the public, is the public aware of it? That's the real problem. And I think my colleague here was making the point, the public is not aware of most of this stuff. Mm-hmm. If you ask them about Milei, it's not on their list of battles. If you ask them about Abu Ghraib, if you ask them about Guantanamo, this is not big on the mental horizon. It's an issue that's buried very thoroughly. If it's brought up at all by the media, it's very lightly, because the media has exactly the same prejudices. Our guys are right, the other side are wrong. If our guys are wrong now and again, then we should cut them some slack, because they're doing this for us after all. I mean, there is a cult of the uniform and the veteran here in the United States, which pervades everything. A veteran, I mean, you know, a veteran can do no wrong. In fact, lots of veterans do wrong. And, you know, the whole point of people in uniform is you're training them to go abroad and kill people. Mm-hmm. And they often do it, excessively, with too much zeal. And so people do feel sympathy for them. You know, I've spoken, everyone calls the Second World War the finest war. I've spoken to many veterans who tell horrifying stories about what happened to prisoners who fell into their hands if they were inconvenient. And, but they're just ignored. People know about them, but the reality is obscured to preserve this overall vision that the United States is a city on the hill. It's not just the United States, of course. Lots of other countries. The British have never held responsible those who committed atrocities in Kenya or in South Yemen or in India, come to think of it, the other places that where they're involved. The French have never come to terms with Algeria. So, you know, it's not a uniquely American problem,
right.
But it is, because America is, the United States is the sort of founding partner of the United Nations, keeps saying it's taking action to uphold international law. Its actions against Iran are wreathed in the obligations to under international law and order, and yet it completely flouts it whenever it suits them. And in this particular case, there were options. I mean, Donald Trump could have said, oh, well, look, these guys, they were young, they're in a terrible situation, so I'll exercise clemency. We'll commute their sentences. But he didn't. He said a pardon. And the pardon implies this is all right, that they are, in effect, judicially speaking, innocent.
Alfred, you both talked about, Ian talked about global jurisdiction. The ICC, ICJ, I mean, the U.S. does not recognize, you know, these international tribunals. So we have had a long record of the U.S. doing things, similar things, since the Korea War, the things that the U.S. did in Afghanistan, you know, the U.N. probe about it and all that. So is there a remedy to this exceptionalism, U.S. forces always being good guys, infallible, great, you know, guys who never do anything wrong?
Well, it's up to us Americans to make sure that our fellow Americans, shall we say, grow up and realize that exceptionalism is not the way forward. But we still live in this bubble, and we still believe that we are the good guys. And it took me decades, actually, to separate myself from that, to, say, jump over my own shadow, to think outside the box. Not everybody does that. Here you are in your comfort zone. But while we're talking about universal jurisdiction, I mean, this can be done, and actually it has occurred. Back years ago, 2007 or 2008, when Donald Rumsfeld went to a right-wing group to speak in Paris, he had to escape because there was a warrant for his arrest. And he left Paris and he went into Germany and was flown back to the United States with a military plane. So you see that there is a possibility under international law to prosecute for war crimes, crimes against humanity, and under the Convention Against Torture, which the United States has ratified.
Right.
Under the Convention Against Torture, there is an obligation of the territorial state to arrest and try whatever person is within its jurisdiction in its territory, like mm-hmm. Donald Rumsfeld at that moment,
right.
who is accused of having committed torture. That is, not he personally, but he as the responsible minister whose soldiers committed torture in Guantanamo and elsewhere. Let me just say one point.
Okay, we have only a few seconds left.
Assange and Snowden, we demand absolutely, and we must demand as Americans, mm-hmm. that the president grant pardon both to Julian Assange and to Edward Snowden, both of whom are human rights defenders.
Okay.
And they have done more for the world than many others, and I think that the campaign against Assange is disgraceful. My colleague Niels Meltzer, rapporteur on torture, has specifically written to Donald Trump and demanded a pardon for...
Okay, Alfred, unfortunately, that's all the time we have. We are out of time. Thank you very much for your comments. We had senior analyst with Foreign Policy and Focus, Ian Williams, out of New York, and former independent expert with the UN Human Rights Council, Alfred Desaias, out of Geneva. And your host, Behrouz Najafi.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked in
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant factor.
Imamat yek asl zinda ast dar tarikh Islam.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism. This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech from IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Sayyid Mohsen Kharrazi. Please stay tuned. Only those are able to act righteously and grow spiritually who do all their deeds according to faith, right deed, and frequent remembrance of Allah. Now, this criterion is true about all professions, even art and poetry. In other words, their art and poetry must be in accordance with Islamic teachings. If the works produced by artists and poets are godly, then they will grow in terms of spirituality and divinity. Such artists are no more misguided or deceived, and have a high status. As a result, the followers of such artistic works are grown spiritually too, and they will be guided into the right path. Therefore, if you want to know who in the eyes of Allah is higher than others, whether it be a poet or artist, it is he who hath faith in Allah, do righteous deeds, and remembers Allah in every moment of his life.
ایمان و عمل صالح و ذکر الله الکثیر بیان میکنه.
Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Khalaf Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Sayyid Mohsen Kharrazi. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en Khalaf Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. Around the World with Reporters.
Christmas holidays are almost over in Italy. It's been a particularly testing time for many as the country is struggling to recover from the economic slowdown caused by the coronavirus pandemic. A study by the National Farmers Association called Diretti has found that about 4 million Italians have been seeking help, many for the first time, to put food on the table during these Christmas festivities. The association has warned the number of people needing food support has doubled compared to last year.
These figures give a snapshot of what the current economic situation is in Italy. 4 million people had to resort to soup kitchens or food pantries this Christmas due to the anti-COVID restrictions. The situation is rapidly aggravating, with our estimates indicating that this year many more will join the ranks of the poor.
About one-third of all people seeking help in Italy during the pandemic are first-time recipients, charitable groups have warned. In a reversal of usual trends, most are Italians and not foreign residents.
According to Coldiretti, among the new poor in Italy, there are those who have lost their jobs, small traders or artisans who were forced to shut down, people employed in the underground economy who do not enjoy special subsidies or public aid and have no savings or assets to fall back on.
E quindi diventa sempre più difficile.
The economic crisis caused by the pandemic is wreaking havoc, especially among the middle classes. We weren't expecting this to happen so quickly.
Alcuni magari avendo perso il lavoro.
Some have lost their job. Some others work much less compared to pre-COVID times. Some friends of mine couldn't buy presents. Some had to give up many other things. It's really hard for an increasing number of people.
The government is reportedly looking at extending the current restrictions until January 15, meaning that non-essential shops will be closed and bars and restaurants can only do takeaway services during weekends. A major question is whether Italy's high schools will reopen as planned on January 7. Max Civili, Rome.
After months of deliberation, witness statements, and arguments made for and against his extradition, the day of reckoning finally arrived, when the world would know the fate of Julian Assange, the co-founder of WikiLeaks. Would he or would he not be extradited to the United States, where he could face up to 175 years in a US supermax prison under special administrative measures? That was the question on everyone's mind. So naturally, there was a big sigh of relief from Assange's supporters when British judge Vanessa Barrister ruled against his extradition, a decision the US prosecutors will certainly appeal.
Since languishing in one of the UK's most notorious prisons after being forcibly removed from the Ecuadorian embassy, supporters of Julian Assange hoped and prayed that the courts would side with their position. But nonetheless, the verdict still came as a huge surprise.
I expected the worst. It's been awful throughout. It's been the way, you know, just everything about the case has been completely illegitimate, basically. And the fact that we won, Julian is free, is just beyond belief.
Yet for those closest to Julian, there was still room for concern.
Today is a victory for Julian. Today's victory is the first step towards justice in this case. We are pleased that the court has recognized the seriousness and inhumanity of what he has endured and what he faces. But let's not forget, the indictment in the US has not been dropped. We are extremely concerned that the US government has decided to appeal this decision.
According to Rebecca Vincent from Reporters Without Borders, the judge's comments still left space for journalists reporting on British and American war crimes to be prosecuted going forward.
Situation for journalism and for press freedom in both the UK, the US and internationally, because what we heard today, the substance of the ruling, or the substance of the judge's decision before she addressed the health issues, was very much that she agreed with the case that the prosecution had made. She threw out many of the defense's arguments, that the free speech arguments and the sort of the arguments that this was indeed a political case. So we disagree with those areas of the decision.
Assange's case has been followed by people from around the world because of its significance and far-reaching implications. And although many are happy with the judge's ruling and ecstatic that Julian Assange will be finally reunited with his family, there was still a feeling that although an important battle had been won, the fight to protect press freedoms and the right to expose US war crimes and crimes against humanity was far from over. Ahmed Kabbalah, London. We'll be right back.
The Islamic movement in Nigeria held a ceremony attended by many of its members to commemorate General Qasem Soleimani. The theme of the event echoed the organization's earlier statement that the world cannot forget the martyrdom of the Iranian general. The Islamic movement described the U.S. assassination of General Soleimani as a war crime, adding that those who carried out the murder must be held to account.
It's very important as an international figure who was able to stop the capture of Syria from the forces of ISIS and Daesh. He was also able to empower the Islamic resistance, the Palestinian Islamic resistance against the Israel. And he's also able to stop the advancement of ISIS in Iraq.
Various speakers at the lecture described late General Soleimani as a strong defender of the Palestinian resistance who took a stand against Zionist occupation forces. They said General Soleimani played an important role in the liberation of the Syrian city of Aleppo and eliminating Daesh terrorists. The speakers described General Soleimani as a champion of interreligious harmony who will be missed.
We feel that we are together with the principles on which General Qasem Soleimani died. And that is the principle of justice, the principle of preventing trying to establish justice on the face of the earth, and also the principle of trying to prevent oppression and tyranny.
The lecturer said the martyrdom of General Soleimani and his ally, Deputy Head of Iraqi Popular Mobilization Units, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, has added a glorious chapter in the history of self-sacrifice. The Islamic movement in Nigeria said General Qasem Soleimani was a man of God and a hero of Islam who succeeded in confronting and defeating enemies of Islam. They said Qasem Soleimani contributed in saving millions of innocent lives and protecting the holy shrines, thereby bringing honor, dignity, and pride to the Muslim Ummah. Benjamin Abdullahi, Kano.
A ceremony attended by Syrians, Palestinians, Iranians, and Yemenis was held in Damascus to mark the first martyrdom anniversary of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Iran's ambassador to Syria asserted that the resistance front will continue to fight back against any aggression, reiterating the assassination was a sign of the weakness of the United States.
By firing the missile on General Soleimani, the U.S. targeted the Iranian people, their power, and pride. The U.S. wanted to thwart the resistance front's plans, but they failed. They have no choice but to leave the region.
Delegates from Syria's Ba'ath Arab Socialist Party and Yemen also delivered words on General Soleimani and his achievements in leading resistance fighters against the Western plots in the region. Vice Secretary General of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine said General Soleimani told him the only path to liberate Palestine was armed struggle and national unity between Palestinians.
And Soleimani,
General Soleimani urged us to depend on ourselves instead of others. Thanks to his efforts and advices, today we make weapons and the Palestinian resistance is currently in constant development.
Photos of General Soleimani were also exhibited, showing moments of his missions across Syria and Iraq. For years, General Soleimani led Iranian military advisors in Syria at Syria's request and played a key role in defeating Daesh terrorists as well as restoring security to hundreds of square kilometers across the Arab country. For over a week, Syrians, Iranians, and Palestinians have commemorated General Soleimani's martyrdom. And as observers say, contrary to the U.S. and its regional allies' will, General Soleimani's assassination has further strengthened unity among all members of the resistance front. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
A compact group of demonstrators took the street again in Paris to protest against police violence, and in particular against the impunity of police officers who used the very controversial method of knee-to-neck choke with fatal consequences. 1 year ago, Cedric Chouviat died after 22 seconds of knee-to-neck choke that caused him fatal wounds. He died in a hospital 2 days later. 4 police officers were directly involved and indicted for involuntary homicide. The family of the victim asked for their suspension.
We have asked the Interior Minister to suspend the 4 police officers involved in the death and the murder of my father. We have been waiting for the suspension for 1 year now. There is no progress at all. We are waiting for a reaction, a real one.
Assa Traore is the sister of Adama Traore, murdered also by the knee-on-neck choke, the same method that killed George Floyd. That led to a worldwide protest asking the ban on such dangerous techniques.
That technique of immobilization used by police forces must be forbidden. That technique is fatal. We have denounced that method for 4 years now because Adam Traore died exactly the same way as Cedric Chouviat, with a knee on his neck. Both said their last words, "I can't breathe." If French authorities had listened to us, Cedric Chouviat would not have died.
This protest is not only against police violence, but also against the global security law that would facilitate police violence, or at least would make it more difficult to film police violence. It's thanks to video footage that the beating of a music producer in Paris by police officers last November was made public.
Abnormal things are happening in this country from the police side. The government is obliged to react because there is an important mobilization, especially from the youth, against the global security law. It's important to withdraw that law.
The march ended under the Eiffel Tower, the place where Cedric Chouviat was choked to death. Cedric Chouviat died with a knee-on-neck choke. As long as this method will not be forbidden by the French government, the impunity of police officers will continue. Chris Den Hont, Paris.
On the first anniversary of the U.S. assassination of Iranian commander General Qasem Soleimani and his companions, Palestinians in the Gaza Strip came together to thank the general for his support in their struggle against the Israeli aggression.
The assassination of General Soleimani has not stopped Iran's support for the Palestinian cause. Our resistance will continue until the liberation of Al-Quds. The blood of General Soleimani will not go in vain. General Soleimani made a turning point in the history of the Palestinian cause.
Many Palestinian leaders and officials joined the mourners and expressed gratitude to Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, who was assassinated in a U.S. airstrike in Baghdad on January. Palestinians consider General Soleimani a symbol of resistance for all the oppressed Palestinians.
We stress that the resistance will continue till all Zionist plots are thwarted in the region. The path of General Soleimani will continue. His assassination has made us more determined to keep the resistance alive.
Palestinians stress that they will follow in the footsteps of General Soleimani, who had a major role in supporting the Palestinian resistance in different fields and making a big difference in the balance of deterrence and rules with the Zionist regime.
General Soleimani was assassinated because he was supporting the resistance front. He always cared about Jerusalem, Al-Quds, and Palestinians. His assassination has made us more united in our fight against the occupation.
Similar gatherings were held in other parts of the region to commemorate the Iranian top commander. Palestinians here consider General Soleimani a symbol of resistance. They say they will continue his path of struggling against the Israeli occupation until the liberation of Palestine and Jerusalem Al-Quds. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
New crimes are added to the Saudi-led coalition's record violations of international law following the death of 22 Yemeni prisoners and the coalition's presence in 2020, all due to torture and medical neglect.
Torture has become a regular thing for the Saudi coalition, and unfortunately, these crimes are being frequent and vary from year to year. This year, 22 prisoners were killed either under torture or medical and food neglect. So we believe that there is an intention to get rid of the prisoners.
The head of Yemen's National Committee for Prisoners Affairs confirms that the UAE keeps hundreds of prisoners in its presence in southern Yemen, despite its refusal to attend any negotiations, while the United Nations has promised to attend amid the humanitarian nature of the prisoners' issue.
The Emiratis are an essential part of this aggression, and they are on the ground and they have dozens of prisons in the lands they occupied here and in the Horn of Africa. We have asked the United Nations to bring the Emiratis for negotiations, but so far there is no response from them and we are still waiting.
2020 witnessed remarkable progress in the liberation of 1,087 prisoners of the Yemeni army and the popular committees, 670 of whom were freed through UN mediation and the rest through local exchange deals.
The Saudi coalition's violations of international humanitarian laws are not only against the prisoners, but against the entire people of Yemen, who are the victims of an ongoing war on their country. Abdul Latif Al Washali, Sana'a.
Tehran University has held a ceremony to mark the anniversary of the U.S. assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Iran's Minister of Science and Technology, who was attending the ceremony, said that universities and academic centers have great capacities to keep the path of Qasem Soleimani alive by studying different aspects of his personality and beliefs.
General Qasem Soleimani was a great person. His personality had different aspects. I believe that academic centers should study his behaviors and personality. I think his lifestyle and beliefs serve as a good role model for all the youth of our country and the world. We have great capacities and potentials at universities and academic centers in this regard.
The event in Tehran came as people and officials attended a ceremony in the city of Kerman, the burial place of General Qasem Soleimani, to remember his lofty status 1 year after his martyrdom.
The martyrdom of General Qasem Soleimani had a big impact on the minds of people, both because of his own personality and what happened after his martyrdom. Therefore, for a researcher and expert of social sciences, his martyrdom provides a wide range of topics to study.
General Soleimani, the commander of the Quds Force of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, IRGC, and his trench mate Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis were assassinated along with their companions in a U.S. terror drone strike near Baghdad International Airport on January 3, 2020. Meanwhile, in response, the IRGC targeted the U.S. airbase of Ain al-Assad in Anbar province in western Iraq to retaliate the U.S. assassination of top Iranian anti-terror commander Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Moreover, according to Iranian officials, Tehran has filed a lawsuit against the U.S. for assassinating General Soleimani, and soon a court session will be held in Iran in this regard. Iranian officials believe that more than anything, the U.S. assassination of General Qasem Soleimani has proved to the global public opinion that the U.S. administration is the leading sponsor of terrorism in the world. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
In gratitude for their sacrifices in confronting America, Israel and the Houthis in the region, Yemenis held an event to commemorate the first anniversary of the martyrdom of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and his companion Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis in the presence of the Iranian ambassador and representatives of the Islamic Resistance Movement.
Today, we live on the martyrdom anniversary of the two leaders, Soleimani and al-Muhandis. Remember the positions of these two heroes to stand by the nation's causes. Haj Qasem Soleimani gave himself to Palestine and the resistance and was intransigent in front of the projects of the Zionist enemy through which it wants to break up the region.
The participants recalled the actions of the martyr Soleimani and how he terrified America and Israel, which thought by assassinating him to weaken the resistance forces, but contrary, it lit a fire that would not be extinguished until the liberation of Jerusalem al-Quds and the demise of global arrogance.
We commemorate the two great martyrs, Haj Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi Muhandis, who strived for God's cause and are loyal to God and did what they were required to do. God gave them wisdom and strength. They were great people, and we should follow their path.
The martyr Soleimani was an icon in the face of the Zionist entity and its projects. He played a great role in supporting the Palestinian resistance movements and stood by the Iraqi Popular Mobilization Forces in its battles with Daesh and Iraq.
Once again, Yemenis have taken a resolve to continue the legacy of General Qasem Soleimani in the face of years of aggression against the impoverished nation by Saudi Arabia and some of its regional allies and their Western backers. Abdul Latif Al Washali, Sana'a.
People have gathered here in Kabul to pay respect to the bravery and the leading role of two significant figures against invading forces and foreign-backed terrorists, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and Afghanistan's national hero, Ahmad Shah Massoud.
Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and our national hero, Ahmad Shah Massoud, were close friends and comrades in the region. Their sacrifices have not been fully highlighted yet, so we need to know them more than ever.
Given the fact that Afghanistan has been repeatedly invaded by some superpowers, mainly over the past two centuries, resistance is considered a familiar concept among the nation. Afghans have had some top resistance leaders like Ahmad Shah Massoud, a national hero who became the victim of a terrorist attack back in 2001. His characteristics are very much similar to that of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani in the eyes of Afghans.
The U.S. expected to remove the name of Qasem Soleimani from the minds of resisting nations by assassinating him. But contrary to those expectations, he became a popular hero, not only for Iranians, but also for all resistance nations across the world, just like Massoud.
Afghans and Iranians share many commonalities in terms of history, culture, religion, and security. Many people here in Afghanistan believe that one of the major similarities between these two nations is their resisting spirit against the invaders. This event in Afghanistan marks the memories of two well-known resistance leaders, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and Afghanistan's national hero Ahmad Shah Massoud. This comes as Afghans themselves are suffering from terrorism and are seeking to follow the path of these two heroes. Syed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me, proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away, proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Going to talk about miscellaneous issues related to Islamic laws issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
Mm-hmm.
little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching Makassas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and his teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Sheikh Tawhid, in the last episode I asked you a question regarding the clothes that can be worn by men and women and the other way around, that the kind of improper clothes that are deemed somehow undesirable for men to wear or for women to wear, in comparison, for example. And I'm sure that some part of it, in fact, remains. So would you please elaborate more on it and shed more light?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Clothes made from pure silk or clothes with gold threads are absolutely forbidden for men. Men cannot wear these kinds of clothes under any circumstances. And this is number one. Of course, clothes of fame or shuhra, okay, in the Arabic terminology or in Farsi.
Yes.
Clothes of fame is forbidden for both men and women, okay? And what does clothes of fame actually refer to? What does it mean? It is clothes, it's a kind of garment whose fabric, whose color, is sewing, or its clothing is not common to the individual and is contrary to his or her social status. Or maybe it is because of its special feature attracts the public attention and make him or make that woman conspicuous, okay?
Yes.
Make that individual stand out. So, this is what we mean by cloth of fame. The color, the fabric, the type of clothes, the kind of fashion, yeah, it might make him conspicuous in the eye of other people, and it might attract their attention. So it's not permissible for that man or for that woman to wear that kind of clothes. And there is also another thing to add. Clothes special to the opposite gender, okay? Mm-hmm. Based on obligatory precaution, Granite Khamenei exercises precaution here. For example, clothes